think, brethren, first it would be good to lay down a basic principle of how prophecy operates. Prophecy in the Old Testament is given first for its own time. It is written with current political situations in mind, in a very current context. Then it has its relationship to future events because of two principles involved. First is the fact that history, basically, is cyclic in nature. The same events produce the same causes, and again, these events produce the same causes, so the messages that were given for a situation then become extremely applicable to a similar situation at a future date. And second, because of the very typical nature of the nation of Israel, that when God was working with Israel, he was developing them as a type, as well as for their own factors in their development. Basically, Israel is a type of nominal Christendom. Nominal Israel is. But there's one important difference to remember as you look at any prophecy, as it deals with nominal spiritual Israel after it was written for nominal natural Israel to begin with. And that is, nominal natural Israel would be punished for their sins, but would be recovered. Nominal spiritual Israel, punished for its sins, is never recovered. And that's where sometimes we run into our confusions in the application of the prophetic pictures. As we discuss in the study this afternoon, the day of Jehovah is a phrase descriptive of that period of time that is preparatory to the mediatorial phase of the kingdom. In its broadest sense, it includes the day of preparation, which we believe began in 1799. More particularly, it relates to those events after the return of Christ. Still more particularly, it relates to those events after the onset of the time of trouble in its general sense. But most particularly, the Day of Jehovah prophecies, especially in the minor prophets, focus down on the last of those series of troubles, that trouble which involves Israel. Brother Frank talked about in Ezekiel 38 and 39, that which we commonly know and refer to as Jacob's trouble. In the Old Testament, there are 24 specific references to the phrase, the day of Jehovah. Exactly half, or 12 of these, are found in the minor prophets. These are scattered through 6 books of the minor prophets. In the first and second chapters of Joel, we find the day of Jehovah as it relates to the Lord's great army. In the book of Amos, chapter 5, we find the day of Jehovah as it relates to heathendom, non-Christian nations. In Obadiah, verse 15, we find the day of Jehovah discussed from the aspects of retribution or recompense in a scripture that is roughly parallel to Revelation 18:6. In Zechariah, the 14th chapter, we find the day of Jehovah as it relates specifically to the final battle with Israel. In Malachi, chapter 4, we find the day of Jehovah as it relates to the true church and its responsibility of warning and that which happens when their warning is not heeded. But most of the prophecies of the day of Jehovah in the minor prophets are found in one chapter. The first chapter is Zephaniah. Zephaniah is the description of the day of Jehovah as given in the minor prophets, and that's the only one we're going to treat in detail because of time. In treating Zephaniah chapter 1, we're going to treat that chapter as though it includes the first 3 verses of chapter 2, because it does. It starts with 1:1 and goes through 2:3. It's broken into 10 sections. Zephaniah 1:1 is an introduction. Verses 2 and 3 are an overview of the entire function of the day of Jehovah. verses 4 to 6 relate to the day of Jehovah as it affects natural Israel. Verses 7 and 8, as it affects Christendom. Verse 9, as it affects the Lord's great army. Verses 10 and 11 come back to Christendom and deal with further reactions. 12 and 13 go back to natural Israel and further reactions there. 14 through 16 we discussed earlier today, and that gives us the titles of the Day of Jehovah. 17 and 18, again the effect on nominal Christendom. And finally, 2:1 through 2:3, the moral of the prophecy. Now with this overview in mind, we're going to rapidly go through all of Zephaniah 1, and if you can open your Bibles, you can follow with us, because we're going to go rather rapidly, because of time, through the first chapter of Zephaniah and the first three verses of the second chapter to capture this overview, the minor prophet description of what is incorporated in the Day of Jehovah. Zephaniah 1:1, the word of the Lord which came unto Zephaniah, the son of Cushi, the son of Gedaliah, the son of Amariah, the son of Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, the son of Amon, king of Judah. In this verse, we learn two important facts. The first fact is that there is a direct relationship, family relationship, between the prophet Zephaniah and the king Josiah. The great-grandfather of Zephaniah is the brother of the father of Josiah. There's two generations different, but they have the same common ancestry in King Hezekiah. These are both descendants of King Hezekiah. Second, we learn that the prophecy is given in the days of Josiah. By comparing chapter 1, verse 1, with chapter 2, verse 2, we can almost pinpoint the date of this prophecy of the Day of Jehovah. And that is sometime between the beginning of the onset of the great reform of Josiah. Remember, Josiah was the one who found the book of the law. He preached a great reform, but it only lasted about 4 years. And then Israel went back into idolatry, and a decree went in from Ezekiel, the fourth chapter, of 40 years of punishment for the failure to heed this reform. And it was sometime after the onset of the reform, but before the decree goes in, that we find this prophecy. The Day of Jehovah is a pronouncement of doom here because of the failure of reform. It is an instigation to bring about this reform, but it is a prophecy of doom, knowing that it will not happen. Verses 2 and 3. I will utterly consume all things from off the land, saith the Lord. I will consume man and beast. I will consume the fowls of the heaven and the fish of the sea, and the stumbling blocks with the wicked, and I will cut off man from off the land, saith the Lord. Here the function of the Day of the Lord is given as a total cleansing, a total removal. Total removal. All things. That which is described in more detail in 2 Peter 3, 7, and 10 as I will remove the heaven and the earth. It is a removal of the ecclesiastical and the governmental societies from this earth. Then he breaks the all things down into parts, man and beast. Now, in the Hebrew, the word man here is preceded by the particle eth. It's eth adam, which means this man and beast. Not all men and beasts, but I will consume this man and beast. What man and beast? Here is why the context of verse 1 is so necessary. That man and beast that did not, that man with his beast, who did not follow the reform of Josiah, who did not come into that reform, who rebelled against that reform, it was against them that this judgment is pronounced. It is specific. It is not general against all men and beasts. Specific against that man and beast that is involved with the breaking from the reform. Then he goes into typical pictures. I will consume the fowls of the heaven and the fishes of the sea. The fowls of the heaven here, we would suggest, are the same fowls that you read about in Revelation 19:17. Those fowls that take root in the branches of Babylon, picturing the despicable aspects of society, the agencies of the great adversary, and the fish of the sea, representing more the laity that was involved and blindly followed the leaders, those that went about in schools, Habakkuk 1:13. That these are the two classes that are involved, the leaders and the blind followers. I would take away the stumbling blocks with the wicked. That's a nice phrase, but it's not accurate. The word stumbling blocks here does not mean stumbling blocks, but ruins. I will take away the ruins with the wicked. What ruins? The ruins caused by the wicked. The wicked, because of their wickedness, brought about the invasions that came upon Israel. And he said, as a result, I'm going to remove these ruins with the ones that have caused those ruins. What he's saying antitypically or prophetically is I will take away the ruins of society, the stubble of society, with the ones that cause that ruin, that stubble in society. I will cut off this man, again, Eth Adama, this one who caused the problems, these rebels, I will cut off from the land. Here again is the function of the Day of Jehovah, to remove the rebels and all that they have affected from the land. Now in verse 4, there's an important four-letter word, also. When we see that word also, and it appears twice in this prophecy, he says, I'm now changing to another group. I'm looking at something else. I will also do this. I've told you what I'm going to do, but in addition, I'm going to do this. I will also stretch out my hand upon Judah and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Here we find he turns and he says, this day of the Lord will also affect Judah and Jerusalem. And we think that they are merely pictorial of the Judah and Jerusalem of the end period of time that we're looking at. That the day of Jehovah will affect natural Israel at this end of the age. But within Judah and Jerusalem, the judgment falls on six classes, not all Jews, but six classes, and he enumerates them. I will cut off the remnant of Baal from his place, the name of the Chemarims with the priests, them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetop, them that worship and that swear by the Lord and that swear by Melcham, they that are turned back from the Lord, and those that have not sought the Lord nor inquire for him. Taking these up individually, we'll notice that these are the six classes, the six types of apostasy that exist today in return, regathered Israel in their land, as well as the Jews who have not regathered. Amongst them, you find a large percentage who are not in any sense of the word religious Jews. You find a large percentage of Jews who return who are agnostic or atheistic Jews. These are among the rebels that he will purge. These, we think, are aptly pictured by Baal, the god of paganism, the god of atheism. These are this remnant of those who follow after the atheistic viewpoints will be purged. These will not come into the land. And you can read this in detail in Ezekiel 20, verses 32 to 34, where in saying he will purge the rebels out from Israel, he said, they shall come out from the lands that they were gathered, but they shall not enter the covenanted land of Israel. They will not come into the covenant relationship of Israel. But there was also the Chemarim with the priests. Here's a joined group. A Chemarim means the black-robed ones. It was a title given to the priests of a certain phase of religion, and it was not a pagan religion. It was a blend of paganism with Judaism. You can see its history in 2 Kings 23:5. These were priests that were appointed by the priests of Israel, the kings of Israel, but they were really pagan in origin. And this, they brought in an element that had to be purged out of Israel. They were brought in by the kings to establish a nationalistic religion. The black robe was only the kind of clothes they wore. That's why they're called the black-robed ones. He will purge out the spirit of nationalism. So much of Zionism has been nationalistic, not religious. And that spirit of blind nationalism is purged out because that nationalism is not dependent upon the Lord. These he links with the priests of Israel who represent the traditionalistic. The blind tradition of Israel and the nationalism of Israel are two elements that are further purged out. He will purge out the host of heaven, or those that worship the host of heaven. In Deuteronomy 4:19, we read more details about this host of heaven. And he said, you would not worship the host of heaven because, not because they were idols, but because these I have given for all people, and not for you alone. But other prophecies, he speaks of the host of heaven as the ones that they began to worship at the time of the golden calf in the departure of Egypt. When they felt they had lost Moses as a leader, they felt the need of human leadership or some symbolic leadership. And we would suggest that this is very possible a picture of those in Israel who worship human leaders. So the following of human leaders is also something that must be purged. Then he says he's also going to purge those that swear by Jehovah. Now that seems odd. Why would he purge those? He does not purge those that swear by Jehovah. He purges those who swear by Jehovah and swear by Malcolm. Those who combined their swearing. The ones who were compromisers within Israel, who swore by Jehovah and swore by Malcolm, both. Malcolm is merely a title that means king or power. Those who worship both the prophets and the prophets, those who worship both, we are Jews, we are very religious Jews, but we also are very power-oriented, prophet-oriented. Again, the commercialism, the commercial aspect, the militaristic Jew as well. These are ones that are purged out by this trouble. And also he will purge those who have turned back from the Lord. Ones who followed the Lord, but followed him half-heartedly, disregarding the law, taking the law more as a form than for its real sense. And that again affects many of the Jews, and that is another group that we've purged out. And finally, he purges out the non-seekers. That's those who have not sought the Lord, nor inquired for him. Here you find the ones who have said, it is no use to follow the Lord. It gets us nowheres. We're Jews. We're content with our Judaism, but we will not look after the Lord. Many of these have returned to Israel. Many of those in Israel represent one or another of these six classes. These are not the Jew of prophetic intent. These are not the Jews that will be the blessed nation. It's that small nucleus, the remnant that is spoken in the third chapter of Zephaniah, that will be pure and come through the trouble. Those are the ones who will be the dew upon the grass. And Isaiah, the sixth chapter, suggests that they may be as few as 10%. And that is also suggested in Ezekiel, the 20th chapter, by that figure of speech, those that pass under the rod. Not only the rod of punishment and chastisement, but the rod that was used to mark the Lord's sheep, 1 out of 10, the tithing rod. That 1 out of 10 perhaps would be the ones who would be holy to the Lord. And this is the nucleus that he deals with, and part of the object of the Day of Jehovah is to purge out the other six classes of Jews. In verse 7 and 8, he turns now again back to Christendom. Hold thy peace at the presence of the Lord God, for the day of Jehovah is at hand. For the Lord has prepared a sacrifice, he hath bid his guests, and it shall come to pass in the day of the Lord's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's children and all such as are clothed with strange apparel. When it says the Lord has a sacrifice, we must understand that term as a statement made in irony. It is not only made here, it is made in Isaiah, the 34th chapter, verse 7. It is made in Ezekiel, the 39th chapter, verse 17. It is made with a different word, not sacrifice, but dinner, in Revelation, the 19th chapter, verse 17. It is the final destruction of Christendom, the great slaughter of the lambs and the goats that you see in Isaiah 34:7. This is his sacrifice, not a sacrifice of worship, but a slaughter. It is a great tearing down, and the word sacrifice is an irony. Not only is that an irony, but also, I have bid my guests, or he has bid his guests. That is also an ironic statement The guests here are the ones mentioned in Revelation 19. The fowl of heaven, the unclean, that he calls in to eat up all the leftovers. That which he is called to completely eliminate, that great system, anti-Christian system of Babylon. He said, this word forbid, though, is interesting. The word forbid here, he has bid his guests, literally is the same word translated sanctify throughout the Old Testament. He has sanctified his guests. But again, taken in its ironic meaning, it merely means he has prepared. He has separated them for their task of eating up that which is left over. It is still spoken in irony. The purpose of it is to punish the rulers, the leadership, the princes and the king's children, and also all those who wear strange apparel. The identification of those who wear strange apparel is given to us in Isaiah, the 4th chapter and the 1st verse. Of those who say that we will call ourselves by your name, but we'll wear our own apparel, our own clothes. Those who try to approach the Lord in their own righteousness, who do not have the robe of justification, they are wearing, as far as the Lord is concerned, imported garments, foreign garments, garments that are foreign to the plan of salvation, garments that will not bring them any deliverance in the time of trouble. And being strange apparel, these will be among those who will be punished in this day of Jehovah. Then in verse 9, he talks about another group. And again, he introduces it with the word also. And in that same day also will I punish all those that leap on the threshold, which fill their master's house with violence and deceit. We don't need to guess too hard who those are that leap on the threshold. Because this is a term that is picked up in another description of the Lord's day. The description in the book of Joel, chapter 2, verse 9. It is one of the descriptions of the Lord's great army, the locusts, that they leap on the threshold, that they leap through the windows. It's also right in the book of Zephaniah, chapter 2, verse 14. He names two of those who leap on the threshold using a little different terminology. Flock shall lie down in the midst of her, all the beasts of the nations, both the cormorant and the bittern shall lodge in the upper lintels, more technically the thresholds of it. Their voice shall sing in the windows, desolation shall be in the thresholds, for he shall uncover the cedar work, or that which covered the thresholds. He would uncover to find the uncleanness that was there in the thresholds. Notice the two animals he mentions, the cormorant and the bittern. These are not totally foreign elements to us. In Isaiah, the 34th chapter, these same elements come in. After the great sacrifice in Edom, then he says Edom will be a desert, and it will be inhabited by the cormorant and the bittern and the screech owl and the wild owl, and he names a whole bunch of these unclean animals. And then he says in Isaiah 35:1, and the desert and the solitary place shall be glad for them, for these destructive elements that has totally leveled this structure of Christendom. This element, though, although they'll be rejoiced because they have brought low mighty Babylon, they also will have to be brought low because their work is not a clean work. And they are the third group that is purged in the day of Jehovah. These are the leapers, we suggest, on the threshold. It's a very similar thought you'd find in the first volume, where Brother Russell describes these as the marauders in Babylon. Bullinger in the Companion Bible says these are the paid thieves, those who are paid to commit thievery. But these are a destroying element. Now in verses 10 and 11, we come to the reaction to this great destructive work of the day of Jehovah. And we find there are four reacting groups. It shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, that there shall be the noise of a cry from the fish gate, a howling from the second, a great crashing from the hills. Howl, ye inhabitants of Maktesh, for all the merchant people are cut down, all they that bear silver are cut off. Here are your four reacting groups. There are those at the fish gate, those at the second, whatever that is, it doesn't say second gate, those from the second, those from the hills, and those from Maktesh. Those at the fish gate were obviously, even as his name suggests, those who merchandised in fish. These were the ones who brought the fish to the city, and they had their fish market set up at the fish gate, and that's why it was called the fish gate. These are people who lived upon the sea and sold their merchandise in the fish gate. We'll just stop there for now. These were seamen that are involved. Second does not say second gate, and most commentaries agree that the word to be supplied is not gate but city, though there would be a crying from the second city. The second city was a city that was established by David on the hill directly west of Mount Zion, what is today known as the Western Mount, or today is miscalled Mount Zion. There was your second city. And so there would be a great howling from this second city. Who lived in the second city? It was the suburbs of Jerusalem. It was where the finer houses were in Jerusalem. Today, when you go to that area, one of the places you are shown is the site of the house of Caiaphas. Very possibly an accurate site. Certainly near that area. It was the wealthy of the city who lived in this suburban area. And he said there would be a cry from these ruling classes of the city who lived over on the second city. The rulers, the priestly rulers, many of the scribes and Pharisees had their more wealthy abodes in the second city. They would be crying out. The hills, these would be the outlying hills around Jerusalem that were dependent for protection upon the strength of the city walls of Jerusalem. If Jerusalem were to fall, then they would lose their protection and they would have nobody to protect them. You can see this in Zechariah, the 8th chapter. And the fourth group, Maktesh, would holler. The word Maktesh means mortar. Mortar, we would think of it today as where you got the pharmacist with his mortar and pestle, that little bowl. It was a geographic term referring to what is called today the Tyropian Valley, the bowl-shaped valley that's between Mount Zion and the Western Mount. And so those in this bowl-shaped valley would mourn. Archaeology tells us that bowl-shaped valley is where the great bazaars were in ancient Israel. It's the merchants that he's talking about. And that's what the verse says. They would mourn because the merchant people are cut off. So the four reacting classes, then, are the seamen, those who made their living on the sea, the merchants, the wealthy class, and the dependents. Three of these classes are again mentioned in Revelation, the 18th chapter, as being the mourners when Great Babylon falls, where it tells how the kings of the earth mourn, how the ship owners mourn, and how the merchants mourn. It is giving the reaction to this great collapse upon the various strata and structures of society. Verse 12 and 13, we come back to Israel. It shall come to pass at that time that I will search Jerusalem. I'll search it with candles. I will punish the men that are settled on their leaves, that say in their heart, the Lord will do not good, neither will he do evil. Therefore, their goods shall become a booty, and their houses a desolation. They also shall build houses, but not inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards, but not drink the wine thereof. Three things to note in these verses. First, I am going to search thoroughly Jerusalem. I'm going to take a candle and a lamp so that I can get into the hidden places. The object of the day of Jehovah is a thorough judgment in preparation for the mediatorial kingdom. He will take his lamps and get into the hidden spots of men's hearts. And this will be particularly true among the Jews, because out of Zion will go forth the law, and out of Jerusalem the word of the Lord. This is the kind of searching that is spoken of in Psalm 29, when he says that my voice will sound as it sounded in Kadesh. Kadesh was the wilderness where he searched, would you go into the land in the first place? But more on that as we get later into the prophecy. After the thorough searching, he says there's one group particularly that I'm going to search out. Those who are settled on their leaves. Now that's an expression we don't use much today. But we have a similar expression We say somebody is resting on his laurels. That somebody is content. He has reached a place where he has satisfied the great problems of life and he is ready to stand there. They're resting on their leaves or settled in their laurels because they say, I am making it by myself. I don't need God. God won't help me. He won't hurt me. These are not ones who disbelieve in God. They just disbelieve that God will get involved. They say he's not going to come to our aid. He's not going to hurt us. This is probably the single largest problem in Israel today. Moshe Dayan's daughter, Yigael Dayan, in her book Dust, it hits this problem so directly when she portrays the victim of the Holocaust in the valley, crying out to the Lord, where were you when we needed you? I found this at my work with one of the Jews I deal with. He said, the Holocaust taught us two things. One, our only security is in Jerusalem, and the second is we got to forget about God because he won't get involved to help us. That's the one you said, no, you have missed the point. That's what ones that will be purged by this day of trouble. Therefore, their goods shall become a booty. That which they have produced through this attitude of we're doing it ourselves. I very much appreciate the thought Brother Frank brought out this morning when he talked about Ezekiel 38, that the spoil in Ezekiel 38 is not oil. It's not some great mineral wealth. But it's that which they have brought out of the land. It's the productivity they have brought to the land. It's the strategic area of the land. It's the agricultural produce. It's all of these things that they have made their little gold mine. It hasn't produced that much gold because you've got to put it back into defense, but its potential is there. What they have done is a miracle with that land. That, I think, is really what the spoil is about. Your goods are what shall become the booty. That's the spoil that he's talking of here in this chapter. And then he goes and he really lays it to their heart. He said, they build houses, but they won't inhabit them. They plant vineyards, but they won't drink the wine thereof. The Israel that will be blessing in the kingdom is not the Israel that is building the Israel today. It is not the individuals who are there only from the standpoint of the political needs that are there and who are men of great ingenuity, but the Israel that is going to be the final blesser are the poor, the meek, the humble, those who will turn to the Lord and those who the Lord will bless and cause to use these things. The others may have built the land, but they won't inhabit it. They may be the ones who are planting the vineyards, but they won't be the ones that are eating the fruit thereof. This produce will go to those who are looking to the Lord for their solutions in the final picture, in the final drawing of the case. Verses 14 to 16 deal with the titles. We can go through this very rapidly because we covered it in our study. This is the great day of Jehovah. It's near. It's near. It hastens greatly. Even the voice of the day of Jehovah. We do want to stop on that phrase. Even the voice of the day of Jehovah. Generally speaking, in the Old Testament, where you find the word voice of God, you can with equal ease put in the word thunder. Because that is the idiom that was used for thunder. Thunder to the Mideast was the voice of God. And this is the thunder of the day of Jehovah. What is thunder? Well, I like the statement was made by, I think it was Owen, when he said it's the noise, the incredible noise. I forget who was talking about that. But it was one of the brethren today mentioned all this talk, and much noise, much controversy. Thunder is the sound of lightning. It's as simple as that. Lightning makes the sound. We hear that sound as thunder. His lightnings enlightened the earth. The earth saw and trembled. When the lightnings of the Lord strike, they cause controversies because people are not ready to acknowledge the great truths that the Lord brings to light. They are too great for their own time, and therefore they cause controversy. They cause noise. They cause turmoil. They cause dissension and discussion. In Revelation, in Brother Ron's talk, he mentioned that there were seven thunders. In Psalm 29, there are seven voices of the Lord. And I think these are roughly equivalent to the seven thunders. We're going to look at just one of these because it's the one that relates directly to Israel. Of the seven thunders in Psalm 29, they are progressive in nature. But the sixth thunder directly comes down with an analogy to Israel. You find this in Psalm 29, verse 8. The voice of the Lord, thunder, shaketh the wilderness. The Lord shaketh the wilderness of Kadesh. You recall in Numbers 14, when Israel came to the promised land, they encamped at Kadesh, Kadesh Barnea. They sent the 12 spies in. 10 came back with a negative report, 2 came back with a good report. Israel did not go into the promised land for 40 more years. The controversy that came over those spies going in was a controversy that proved their lack of faith. This is picked up in picture in Hebrews, the 4th chapter. They, because of unbelief, did not enter into their rest. They did not come into that land of rest. This is the picture he's picking up. He said, I'm going to plead with you in Kadesh. Ezekiel 20 puts it this way. He said, I'm going to bring you into the wilderness of the people. And there will I plead with you like as I pleaded with your fathers in the wilderness. There will I purge out the rebels. That's part of the purpose of the day of Jehovah. It is this pleading in Kadesh. It is this thunder of the day of the Lord. It is this great controversy over how the Lord is dealing. Will Israel today have the faith to enter into their covenant promises? Isaiah 6 indicates 10% will. That may be incorrect thought on Isaiah 6:13, but certainly Zephaniah, the 3rd chapter, says it is only a small remnant that will have that privilege of entering in. But to that remnant, it will be wonderful. Then he goes on and describes the day. Oh, first he says, the mighty man cried bitterly. Those who have been the strong ones, those who have been the ones confident in their might, these are the ones who will cry because of the frustration that their might does not produce the victory they hoped. That in the final analysis, Jerusalem is taken. Half the city goes into captivity. And then the Lord steps in and fights for them as he fought in the day of old. He says that day is a day of wrath. Revelation 15:1. It's the day of the plagues in which is filled up the wrath of God. It is a day of trouble and distress, the natural effects. It is a day of wasteness and desolation as it totally lays low in preparation for restitution. It is a day of darkness and gloominess. The uncertainty that is there as to why this is all coming upon them, the not knowing which way to go and the discouragement therefrom. It is a day of clouds and thick darkness, of total obscurity when they cannot see the Lord's hand directing their affairs and only know that some force out of their control is forcing things away from their own power to determine their destiny. You read more of that in Isaiah 28:21, when they call God's work of that time a strange work, a work they can't figure out. Nahum 1:3. In Nahum 1:3 it says the clouds are the dust of Jehovah's feet. As he moves, it stirs up the dust and obscures their vision because they cannot follow his moving. The day of trumpet and alarm caused by the fear of the time, not knowing the cause of that trouble. Because the day of the Lord shall be against both the fenced cities and against the high towers. The fenced cities are very accurately described for us in Jeremiah, the 8th chapter, verse 14. They are the confines of Christendom. There you may recall the great company in prophecy says, let us enter into the defense cities and be silent there. We will go into this area because the Lord our God has put us to silence. And they stay so long that finally in bitterness they cry out, the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. The high towers. There's an interesting line of thought our time won't permit. I'm going to give you some scriptures to go into more detail on the high towers. In Isaiah 33:18, this goes to what? 8 o'clock, read 15.
Take
8:10. 8:10, yeah. I'll just give you the scriptures. I don't have time. Okay. The high towers in Isaiah 33:18, you will find one of the three categories in the consideration of the time of trouble being the divider of towers. There you can take that word divider, and that will take you to your second connection, which is in Daniel, the 7th chapter, verses 24 to 28, where the time of trouble is also broken into the same three phrases. There you have Mene, Tekel, and Upharsin, the weigher, the counter, and the divider of towers. And then you can take that over to Matthew 12:26, where the divider of towers is shown to be the split that occurs in Satan's empire, the division of his empire as it is split into its multiple forces that bring about its final desolation and destruction. The last two verses of the first chapter deal with the effect on nominal Christendom and upon mankind in general. I would bring distress upon men. They shall walk like blind men because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be poured out as dust, their flesh as the dung. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath. But the whole land shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy. For he shall make a speedy riddance of all them that dwell in the land. How does a blind man walk? Not very straight. He staggers. There are two kinds of men that stagger. The drunkard and the blind. Two different causes. The Bible uses both symbolically. The drunkenness it uses in Isaiah 24:20. There it is the intoxication that comes with the, that brings the headiness of power, as you see in Revelation 17:2 and 18:3. But also blindness causes men to stumble. When they don't know the way, when they aren't given the information, and that blindness is what is emphasized here. Here it is not emphasizing their drunkenness, but it's emphasizing their lack of knowledge. He said, because they lack knowledge, they don't know how to walk or write, and they stumble about in their blindness. He says that their blood is poured out as dust and their flesh as dung. All their life, their whole giving of their life itself is deemed as worthless. It is something just to be cast in the streets because there is no value to it. He says they may try to buy their way out with silver and their gold, but the silver and gold is worthless. The prosperity, all materialism, will be of no value to save in that time of God's jealousy. And it is the fire of his jealousy. Jealousy because God knows that he alone is worthy of complete worship. Because he realizes it's for the best of the ones he loves to love him and him alone. And for that reason, when they love others, his fire of jealousy goes out. Because in that jealousy, he sees that is their only way to their salvation. It says he will make a speedy riddance. This makes us think of Romans 9:28, when it says he will make a short work in the land. In Romans 9:28, in case you had a problem tracing that in the Old Testament, is a direct quotation from Isaiah 10:23, but not the King James, the Septuagint of Isaiah 23. And it reads this way: he will finish the work and cut it short in righteousness, because the Lord will make a short work in all the world. Well, it may be long from our reckoning, but from God's reckoning, it's a very speedy riddance. It is a very short work that he makes upon those that dwell. The former inhabitants, those who had been the inhabitants of Babylon the Great, of Christendom, these are the ones that are cast out. From one sense, the whole system is overturned, never to rise again, as is found in Revelation 18 with the millstone. From another sense, there will always be Christendom. There will always be a worship of Christ. And that's why in Obadiah verse 19, it says, they of the south, the ancient worthies, shall possess as an occupying army the Mount of Edom. That there will be always an eternal Christendom, but no longer in the hands of the nominal Christian, but in the hands of the ancient worthies come back from the dead. Those same ones of the south mentioned in Zechariah 14, where you got the Mount of Olives divided north to south. Concluding, the first three verses of the second chapter give the moral to the story. Gather yourselves together. Collect your thoughts. Put it all together. Get the lesson from this thing. Come to your senses. Gather yourselves together. Yea, gather together, O nation not desired. In one early reprint article, this is referred to the true church. But generally, we think that this is not the true church here, but it's Babylon, a nation that is cast off, a nation that is rejected. And he's saying to them one last time, your final chance for repentance. Put it together before the decree, before the destruction becomes inevitable, possibly before 1914 in the reality, possibly something else. But he says, to the last moment, before the decree brings forth, before the day passes as a chaff, before the full consumption, before the fierce anger of the Lord come upon you, before the day of the Lord's anger come upon you personally, seek ye the Lord. Seek ye the Lord, first ye meek of the earth. The qualification to seek him. That you must be one of those who are the meek of the earth in order to seek the Lord. You which have wrought his judgment. The only way that you're seeking for the Lord will be rewarded is by following his judgments and watching them. You seek righteousness. Seek meekness. It might be that you shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. It may be that even those at the last minute have a repentant heart, that they will not need to go through the rigors of this great day of Jehovah. It's not a pretty picture. It's a picture of great judgment. The day of Jehovah is pictured in the minor prophets as a day that lays low the societies of the earth. But it's a picture that is only a prelude to a beautiful picture. The day of Christ. The day of mediation. The day of the Prince of Peace. The day of full restitution and resurrection from the dead. The effects of that day of Jehovah on Christendom, total destruction. On Israel, purgation, purging the rebels so that the remnant can serve the Lord. On mankind, a humbling experience, Job chapters 38 to 41. And for the true church, it should be an experience that is an incentive. As Peter puts it in 2 Peter 3:11, seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought we to be in all holy conversation and godliness?